Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Have you ever come across a historical figure who just, well, completely breaks the mold? Someone who was, say, a world-class artist, but also a fierce warrior, and on top of that, a self-proclaimed genius favored by God.
Right.
And then he wrote it all down himself in this incredible, sometimes pretty boastful account.
You must be talking about Benvenuto Cellini.
Exactly. Many of you might know his name, maybe for the famous Perseus statue, or perhaps just his legendary ego. But today we're doing a deep dive into the extraordinary life of this truly multifaceted Renaissance man.
And our main guide is Cellini's own autobiography. The full Italian title is quite a mouthful. Vita di Benvenuto di Maestro Giovanni Cellini Fiorentino, scritta per lui medesimo in Firenze.
Okay, let's break that down a bit.
It basically means The Life of Benvenuto, Master Giovanni Cellini of Florence, written by himself in Florence. So right away, you get that strong Florentine pride and, well, the self-importance.
Written by himself.
Exactly. Now, he actually dictated it to a young helper between 1558 and 1566, but it wasn't published until much later, 1728.
Wow.
And this isn't your typical dry historical record. Oh, yeah. No, it's raw, it's intensely personal, and yeah, incredibly self-aggrandizing. It kind of rips the serene classical mask off the Renaissance.
So our mission today.
Our mission is to unpack this monument to a colossal ego, really, and an untamable spirit. We want to pull out some surprising insights about the Renaissance itself and maybe about the nature of genius, too.
Okay, so just to quickly place him for everyone, Benvenuto Cellini, born in Florence, 1500, died 1571.
Florentine to the core.
And is CV, goldsmith, sculptor, medalist, soldier, musician, and author.
He really did tick all the boxes for a high Renaissance and Mannerist figure. That Manner style, you know, it's all about the drama, the flair, pushing beyond those calmer high Renaissance ideals.
Right, you see that in his work, and clearly in his life story, too. So this defiant character, let's trace it back. How did it all start, his early years in Florence?
Well, he was born on All Saints Day, 1500. And he certainly thought that was significant, a sign of a special life ahead.
An omen right from day one.
Pretty much. His father, Giovanni, was a musician for the Medici family, a respected position. And he really pushed young Benvenuto towards music.
But Benvenuto wasn't having it.
Not really. He was drawn to disegno design, drawing, and especially working with metal, goldsmithing. So right there, you have this tension. Father's wishes versus his own calling. That was, you could say, his first rebellion.
Setting the stage for many more, I imagine.
Absolutely. And there's this incredible story he tells from his childhood. His father saw a salamander in the hearth fire, a creature supposedly able to live in fire, a real marvel.
Uh-huh.
And his father was so struck by it, he actually boxed young Benvenuto's ears.
What? Why?
Not out of anger, Cellini says, but so the boy would never forget seeing such a miraculous thing.
Wow. That's intense. And says a lot about their worldview, doesn't it?
It really does. Very focused on signs, omens, divine intervention. And this incident seems to have fed Cellini's later belief that he was special, watched over. And that quick temper, it showed up early. Brawls, fights. He got banished from Florence more than once, even as a young man.
So his education wasn't exactly sitting in a classroom?
Not at all. He learned his craft in goldsmiths' workshops, and apparently he picked it up incredibly quickly, surpassing his masters. But his real coming of age was on the road, often because he'd had to flee Florence after, you know, a duel or some other trouble.
So where did he go?
He traveled through Siena, Bologna, Pisa. Honing his skills, yeah, but also building this reputation. Brilliant artist, but also a kind of a dangerous guy to cross.
A hothead.
Definitely. But Rome, when he got there as a young man, that was his real university.
It's the center of everything then.
Exactly. The heart of artistic patronage. Ancient wonders to study. He was looking at ancient Roman sculpture, competing with the best artists alive, making exquisite jewelry and medals, and, you know, getting into street fights at night.
The combination again. Delicate art, deadly sword.
That was Cellini. He was already crafting his persona.
And this is where things really take off for him, career-wise, under Pope Clement VII.
Yes, his talent was undeniable. But the event that really cemented his self-image, the one he talks about constantly, was the sack of Rome in 1527.
A truly catastrophic event for the city.
Terrible. Imperial troops mutinying, storming the city. But Cellini, he didn't just run. He took up arms.
So he became a soldier.
And in his autobiography, he's not just a soldier. He's practically the hero of the defense of Castel San Angelo, where the Pope took refuge.
What does he claim he did?
Well, among other things, he claims he personally aimed and fired the cannon that killed the enemy commander, the Constable of Bourbon.
Okay, that's a huge claim. Is there any truth to it? Or is that pure Cellini self-promotion?
Well, historians confirm he was there. He definitely fought bravely. The bit about personally killing the constable, that's generally seen as an exaggeration, a classic Cellini embellishment.
Right. Shaping the narrative.
Exactly. But true or not, his actions did impress the Pope. He earned huge favor, and it solidified his image both to others and, crucially, to himself as a man of virtu.
Explain virtu again. It's not quite virtue as we think of it, is it?
No, not just moral goodness. It's more like skill, courage, audacity, power, excellence, that force of will, being master of your craft and master of your fate, art and war combined.
Okay, so the sack of Rome proved his virtu, and his fame grew.
Exponentially. This led to major commissions. The most famous from this period is probably the Saliera, the salt cellar he made for King Francis I of France. It's an absolute masterpiece of goldsmithing. You can still see it today.
Incredible piece. But knowing Cellini, did court life in France go smoothly?
What do you think?
Probably not.
Exactly. His arrogance, his temper, his inability to just, you know, play the political game. It led to clashes. He eventually had to leave France and head back to Italy.
Which, in a way, paved the way for his biggest artistic challenge, right?
Precisely. Back in Florence, Duke Cosimo de' Medici commissioned him to create a massive bronze statue, Perseus, with the head of Medusa.
The one in the Piazza della Signoria. Iconic.
That's the one. And the story of its casting, as Cellini tells it.
Oh,
it's epic. A battle against fire, against metal, against fate itself. It's like the climax of his entire life's philosophy played out in the workshop.
We'll definitely need to unpack that story later.
Yeah.
So Perseus was a triumph. Did that finally bring him some peace in his later years?
It brought him immense fame, yes. But peace. Not really Cellini's style. There were still disputes, constant rivalries, especially with another sculptor, Baccio Bandinelli. He hated Bandinelli.
So even with that success?
The conflicts continued. And it was during this later period, from 1558 onwards, that he started dictating his life story.
To his apprentice.
Yeah, a young kid, just 14 years old. Imagine listening to these stories. This autobiography became his final great work. He'd shaped metal. Now he was shaping his own story, his legacy.
So the book itself is like a final act of creation.
Definitely. It's partly a defense proof justifying his actions. It's partly an adventure story starring himself as the hero. It's partly an art treatise. He used it to settle old scores, puff up his achievements, and make sure he got the last word. He died in 1571, leaving us these amazing artworks and this equally amazing, incredibly revealing self-portrait in words.
Okay, so let's dig into that mindset. Beyond the fighting and the boasting, what was the core philosophy here? You mentioned virtu.
Yes, virtu is central. That blend of skill, courage, audacity, excellence, force of will. He saw it as a divine gift.
Which connects to his belief in divine favor.
Directly. He was convinced God was on his side. He saw omens, constantly remember the salamander. And especially during his imprisonment, he had these intense mystical visions. He felt persecuted, sure, but also divinely protected, saved for great things.
And this led to that astonishing idea that great artists are above the law.
That's what he believed. He actually wrote, and this is a direct quote, "Know then that men who are unique in their profession, like myself, are not bound to observe the laws."
Wow. Just why?
It's a stunning statement, isn't it? A very personal, perhaps self-serving definition of genius. It blended Renaissance humanism's focus on individual potential with an almost medieval level of superstition and, let's be honest, staggering egotism.
So with that worldview, what he really want, what was driving him day to day?
Primarily, fame, glory, what he called fama. He wanted his name to last forever, like Michelangelo's.
And money.
Money was important, but more as proof of his value. Getting paid well by a pope or a duke was a sign of respect, a measure of his worth, but fama was the ultimate goal.
And what about all the fighting, the vendettas?
That ties into a sense of honor and justice, which was, again, very personal. If someone slated him or cheated him or insulted his art, it wasn't just an offense, it was an attack on his virtu, on his very being. He saw settling those scores as, well, almost a holy duty, restoring the balance that villains had upset.
He really did cast himself as the hero in his own epic, didn't he? So facing adversity, which he clearly did often, how did he cope?
He never backed down, ever. Adversity wasn't a reason to quit. It was a test, a chance to prove his virtue.
So what was his strategy?
It was a mix against human enemies, aggression, often violence, against technical problems in his art, incredible ingenuity, thinking outside the box, against forces beyond his control, like illness or imprisonment. Deep faith, that conviction of divine protection. He was incredibly resilient. Every escape, every triumph just reinforces belief that he was special, untouchable.
Okay, let's zoom in on three moments you mentioned that really seemed to define him. First, back to the sack of Rome, 1527.
Right. This is huge. Emperor Charles V's unpaid, mutinous troops attacking Rome. Chaos. Cellini switches from artist to soldier, defending Pope Clement VII and then Castel San Angelo.
And making those big claims about his role.
Exactly. He claims he fired the fatal shot against the enemy commander. Whether true or not, the experience transforms him. It solidifies his self-image as this Renaissance man of action. It boosts his status hugely with the Pope. It proves to himself and others that his virtue isn't just in his hands, but in his courage, too. It validated everything he wanted to believe about himself.
Okay, pivotal moment number one. Then number two, the irony of being imprisoned years later, 1538-39, in the same castle he defended.
The ultimate reversal. Pope Paul III, a different pope, has him arrested, accused of embezzling jewels during the sack, ironically enough. Most historians think the charges were trumped up by his enemies.
What was the imprisonment like?
Horrific, by his account. Terrible conditions. He even broke his leg badly, attempting a daring escape, solitary confinement, deep despair. But?
But for Cellini, there's always a but.
Always. In that darkness, he has these intense religious visions. He sees celestial beings, feels God's presence directly. He comes out of it more convinced than ever that he is special, chosen, persecuted by evil men, but preserved by divine power. The suffering becomes a badge of honor, proof of his unique soul.
It reinforces the myth.
Completely. It becomes a cornerstone of his legend.
And the third turning point. The casting of Perseus. You said it was dramatic.
Oh, beyond dramatic. This is 1545 to 1554. Duke Cosimo wants this huge bronze statue, a massive technical undertaking. Cellini sets up the workshop, makes the models, prepares the mold. Then comes the moment of truth. The pour.
And things go wrong.
Spectacularly wrong. He describes a sudden, violent storm erupting. Then a fire breaks out in the workshop. And then, the worst possible thing, the molten bronze starts to clot. It's not flowing properly into the mold. Disaster looms.
The whole project could fail right there.
Total failure. Years of work. His reputation on the line. But Cellini, in this moment of crisis, he has this flash of desperate inspiration. He starts yelling at his assistants, tells them to grab all his pewter, household dishes, plates, bowls, everything.
His dishes?
Yeah. About 200 pieces, he says, and throw them into the furnace, into the molten bronze.
Why?
Pewter has a lower melting point and contains tin and sometimes lead. Adding it would thin the sluggish bronze mixture, make it flow better. It was a huge gamble, sacrificing his own belongings.
Did it work?
Miraculously, yes. The bronze liquefied, flowed perfectly, filled the mold, the cast was saved, Perseus was born.
Incredible.
For Cellini, this wasn't just a technical fix. This was everything. It was the ultimate proof of his philosophy. Genius, virtue, sheer force of will, triumphing over metal, fire, bad luck, everything. It was the ultimate validation.
It's easy to focus on these big dramatic moments, but his day-to-day reality must have been tough too. Just the external stuff.
Oh, absolutely. You have to remember the context. He lived through outbreaks of plague. Political turmoil was constant, popes changing, dukes fighting, cities warring.
Not exactly stable conditions for creating delicate art.
Not at all. And then the practical side. Constantly battling patrons for money. They'd commission work, but be slow to pay, or argue over the price. Sourcing materials, gold, silver, huge amounts of bronze for something like Perseus was a major headache and expense.
And the technical challenges themselves, like that Perseus casting.
Monumental. These weren't things you could just look up in a manual. He was pushing the boundaries of craft and engineering, often with immense risk of failure. It wasn't just personal drama. It was a constant struggle against the constraints of his time.
And speaking of struggles, let's talk controversies. His autobiography isn't just self-praise. It's almost a confession booth at times, right? He admits to killing people.
He absolutely does. Quite openly, yeah. He details killing the soldier who murdered his brother. He talks about assassinating a rival goldsmith named Pompeo in Rome. He mentions other killings in brawls or during the sack of Rome.
How does he justify these?
Always as righteous. It was revenge for his brother, or self-defense, or dealing with villains who deserved it. Remember that quote? My lord, I have put a man to death, but it was a villain. He said he would kill me, so I have been beforehand with him. That's his logic. Justice, Cellini style.
What else? Any other charges?
Oh, yes. Assault, definitely. Theft accusations, like the embezzlement charge that landed him in prison, and quite seriously back then, multiple accusations of sodomy. He was actually convicted on one charge later in life and had to pay a heavy fine and endure a period of house arrest.
So, creator of beauty, but also brutal.
That's the paradox. He embodies this idea of the artist as almost a warlord, capable of sublime creation, but also ruthless violence. It complicates the picture immensely.
Did he ever see himself as failing, though?
Mm-hmm.
Or did he always spin it?
He almost never admits failure in the book. Setbacks happen, yes, but they're always someone else's fault. Treachery, jealousy, incompetence by others. Well, losing his prestigious position at the French court under King Francis I, that was a huge blow professionally. But does he frame it that way? No. He presents it as his righteous decision to leave a corrupt environment where his genius wasn't appreciated.
And he immediately lands the Perseus job back in Florence.
Exactly. See? Triumph snatched from the jaws of someone else's failure to appreciate him. And the Perseus, casting itself, that near disaster, it becomes his finest hour. The moment his genius saved the day by sacrificing his pewter, he was a master, maybe above all else, of controlling the narrative. Defeat wasn't really in his vocabulary, at least not when telling his own story.
So let's pull back and think about the legacy. What's the biggest impact Cellini has had, both artistically and culturally? How should we understand him today?
Artistically, he's undeniably a major figure of mannerism. The Saliera, Perseus, these are masterpieces. His technical skill was astounding. And his written treatises on goldsmithing and sculpture are invaluable historical sources for how things were actually made.
And culturally, beyond the art world.
The autobiography itself had a massive impact, especially in the 19th century. The Romantics just devoured it. They saw Cellini as the perfect archetype of the passionate, misunderstood, rule-breaking genius. The tortured artist figure owes a lot to him. His book gave people this incredibly vivid first-person glimpse into the Renaissance warts and all. It shaped the popular image of the era, maybe more than Dreyer histories.
The book really is a force in itself, isn't it? You mentioned its style dictated colloquial.
Exactly. It feels spoken. It's got this energy, this directness. He jumps between describing intricate metalwork and recounting a bloody brawl with the same kind of gusto. It's dramatic, full of tangents, just like someone telling you stories.
And the perspective is, well, biased.
Gloriously subjective. Cellini is always the hero. His enemies are always treacherous villains. God is always intervening on his behalf. It is absolutely a masterclass in self-promotion.
So its value isn't necessarily factual accuracy.
Not primarily. Its real value is psychological. You see the world exactly as Cellini saw it, or at least how he wanted it to be seen. You get incredible insight into his motivations, his fears, his towering ego. It's transparent in its subjectivity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Mm. So summing that up, strengths and weaknesses of the autobiography.
Strengths. Hugely entertaining. It reads like an adventure novel. It's a priceless historical document for understanding Renaissance, life, art, attitudes. And it's a profound psychological portrait.
Weaknesses.
Well, it's notoriously unreliable on the facts. The egotism can be overwhelming page after page of how great he is. And then there's the darker side. The casual brutality, the violence, the misogyny, the complete lack of remorse for actions that are, frankly, appalling to us now.
It forces you to confront that difficult idea, doesn't it? That great art can come from someone deeply flawed.
Exactly. It shatters any neat, tidy image of the great artist. Beauty and brutality coexist in Cellini, and the book doesn't let you ignore it. When you really dig into Cellini, what hits you emotionally is this raw sense of artistic pride and maybe vulnerability too. His whole story screams about the creative ego, you know, that desperate need to be recognized, the fury when you feel underestimated, and that absolute joy when you create something amazing and overcome the odds.
Like the Perseus casting.
Exactly. You can almost feel that tension, that desperation, then the relief. It's about pouring your soul into your work and demanding the world see its worth. I think many people can connect with that feeling, even if not on Cellini's dramatic scale. And the big intellectual takeaway, for me, it's that the Renaissance wasn't some calm, orderly, sunlit period of classical rebirth we sometimes imagine. Cellini's life just blows that myth apart.
It was messy.
Incredibly messy, brutal, chaotic, deeply superstitious, violent. His story shows you the reality of art tangled up with power, politics, money, and violence. It's a much more complex and, frankly, more interesting picture of the era. And maybe the most universal lesson here. It's about writing your own story. Cellini's final masterpiece wasn't made of bronze or gold. It was his autobiography. He knew memory is selective and a powerful narrative can shape how you're remembered.
Controlling the legend.
Precisely. Whether every detail was factually true is almost beside the point. He seized control of his own legacy. He made sure he'd be remembered on his terms as the brilliant, divinely favored, unstoppable force he believed himself to be. It's a potent reminder about defining yourself rather than letting others do it for you.
Benvenuto Cellini, he really does remind us that behind the polished surfaces of Renaissance art, there was this incredibly turbulent, messy, intensely human world. His story is just such a potent antidote to that sanitized version of history we sometimes get. It's raw, it's vital, unforgettable, a real glimpse into the fiery heart of that era. And perhaps, as you think about crafting your own narrative today, maybe there's something to consider in the sheer audacity and force of Will Cellini used to forge his own legend. We hope this deep dive into Benvenuto Cellini and his autobiography has sparked some thoughts and maybe offered some surprising insights. Thanks for joining us. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.